Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
It is 9:49 here. Yeah, I didn't intend to do this. I didn't intend to do this today. The former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, did an interview the day before yesterday. And, so, you're going to hear that. So, always a treat to hear Joe Dunford talking about leadership. So, so we're going to do that now. The here's a email. You don't seem to draw a distinction between the political elites of this country. I think a lot of people do. I think a lot of people somehow or other convince themselves that even though these people live in the rarefied air of the political aristocracy in this country, that somehow or other they still relate to them. You seem to be beyond that. And have contempt for all of them. That would be a statement based in fact. I do. I don't know if contempt, right? I mean, how the fuck do you look at George Bush with any kind of fondness? Bill Clinton? Bill Clinton's been lying his whole fucking life. But if he was your party's liar, then I guess that makes it okay. His wife? Been there every step of the way with him. I mean, Joe Biden? Just follow Joe Biden's career. It's a fucking shit show. Donald Trump? Shit show. Barack Obama? Community organizer? President of the United States. Amazing. Of all of them, Obama doesn't fit the mold. But it's this grand game of Parcheesi, you know, with the future of the nation. To me, something has to be done about elections in the country. I've said this for a long, long time. And has to start with campaign finance reform. But the Supreme Court struck down key elements of McCain-Feingold. So that corporations can contribute to political campaigns. But they don't vote. They can't contribute. So, yeah, I do. And again, if you could see what's the difference between, you know, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, Joe Biden. I mean, what's the difference? Some of their beliefs? Let me tell you, if there's a family that holds military service in contempt, it's the Clintons. She was legendary for it. When he got inaugurated, who did he replace? The Bushes, right? So it was customary that if you had school-age kids, I want to say Marines or some military attaché took them to school. Hillary Clinton would not allow it. And it's not like she, you know, took him to school. Like, I'll take my daughter to school. No, it wasn't like that. No, it's, you will not do that. And their contempt for the military was legendary. And you hear Marines talking about it because I was stationed in D.C. at the time or in Quantico. And they'd come down and it'd be a subject of conversation. That's bullshit. Oh, no, it's not. And so contempt for military service, come on. It's what, I mean, elites would never do that. Are you kidding me? Allow my daughter to do that? Allow my son? God, no. You know? So I don't know. Again, I don't know how you fix it. I don't know how you fix it. But that's, I said this in the election of 2016. This is the best the nation has to offer. This is as good as we could do. Something's broke in our country. The electoral process. And then you look at and again, ballot harvesting has been going on for years. When it's, I mean, if you want a great education into the slimy nature of American politics, go watch the movie Lincoln. And watch how they get amendments passed. Yeah. Go watch that one. It's amazing. All right. This is the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I'll get out of the way for him. It's a series called Leading from the Front. And it's done, this interview is done by the Marines Memorial Club. All right. So I've never been, but it's a famous hotel in San Francisco. I think Mike Myatt, or he used to run it. I don't know who runs it today.
From leading the first combat units into Iraq to leading the entire U.S. military as a two-term chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Joe Dunford has always led from the front and continues to do so in his encore civilian career, helping to bring peace to Afghanistan, care and welfare to wounded military personnel and their families, and guiding the next generation of flag officers with the leadership lessons he first learned from his father, a Boston cop and former Marine, and refined over 42 years of service to his country and Corps. As part of the Marines Memorial Association's tradition of honoring commitment and sharing timeless leadership lessons learned in all walks of life, the conversation continues in this online extension of what normally takes place at the Marines Memorial Club, a public, nonprofit hotel, theater, restaurant, and event space in downtown San Francisco, serving generations past and generations to come for nearly 75 years and counting. I'm correspondent Mike Saray, and this is Leading from the Front. Personal opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Marines Memorial Club. General Dunford, welcome to a rather quiet but still very active Marines Memorial Club.
Hey, thanks, Mike. It's good to see you.
You know, I had the pleasure of observing your leadership skills firsthand while being embedded with your 5th Marines during the Iraq invasion. And I'll recall one of your leadership traits when it has to do with dealing with reporters like myself, and that was be polite, be courteous, but don't be too available.
Well, I'm violating that rule today, Mike, and I'm being available. You know, my philosophy, just to bring it up, I mean, this is now many years ago, we were together in Iraq, but it was a conscious decision, and I think really across the entire division, but certainly within the 5th Marines, that the ones who would be best able to tell a story were the young Marines that were doing the heavy lifting. And so, well, you commented on my availability. I don't think anyone would criticize the availability of the Marines within the 5th Marines.
They were a chatty group. They always had something to say.
That's right. And we didn't ever try to control what they said. We just said, hey, just be yourself, tell your story, and talk about your unit. And our philosophy was if we did that, it would turn out fine. And that the American people, which really was the target audience, it was the moms and dads back home that were watching your newscast.
Now, I don't want to put a bum rap on you because talking about availability, because you didn't do many interviews, but I'll tell you what, you did give me some very vital information as we were both running from a porta potty at Camp Coyote in Kuwait when the invasion was somewhat imminent. We were moving out of that position and moving up to the DMZ, so to speak, and you were sharing with me some very confidential information, which I kept confidential, but it helped me immensely in my job, and I'll never forget that.
Oh, that's great.
Joe, as the son of a Boston cop and former Marine in Pyongyang in Korea, the nephew of two World War II veterans, the oldest of six brothers, has there ever been a time in your life when you weren't leading or asked to lead?
Well, you know, Mike, I was born a fire team leader. I couldn't do anything about it. The oldest of six sons.
So let's talk about leadership, where it comes, it fits into your lifespan here. Starting with your family, was that the greatest source of inspiration for you and as far as learning about leadership?
Mike, I think it was. I mean, I was blessed to have a father who was my role model. He was a Marine in the 1950s, and I had several uncles that were in World War II. And so I think both my commitment to serve as well as my views on leadership were founded early on from my family. And then to be honest with you, I had a lot of good teachers and coaches and so forth over the years that I was exposed to. And not the least of which was my high school, which had a philosophy of you should go out in the world and be a person for others. It was an all-boys high school, so the motto was be a man for others. And of course, in the event, that's pretty consistent with what's expected of a Marine leader.
Now, that's Boston College High School, a Jesuit school. And how did your Jesuit education, which is kind of the Catholic's equivalence of the Marine Corps, factor into the coda, your ethics and moral coda that guided you through your whole career?
Yeah, Mike, I think what I strove to be, in part inspired by that Jesuit model, was to be a servant leader. And as I mentioned, the motto was be a person for others. And so you should always put the needs of your subordinates ahead of your own. And that's certainly consistent with being a Marine leader. And I think also that education was a good founding. I can remember many times being reminded, before you start to solve a problem, make sure you understand exactly what the problem is. And so, you know, the intellectual framework of my education, I think was helpful as well.
And as you went through your career, and very critical, being the leader of warriors and having to send people into harm's way, was there ever a time where you felt this was slightly in conflict with what you had studied and learned earlier in your life?
No, you know, Mike, to tell you the truth, no. I never found myself either being asked to do something that was inconsistent with my values. I think there's obviously some ambiguity in war you have to work your way through, but I think I had thought about it enough, studied it enough, and had the benefit of other mentors to the point where when the time came, I was able to think through the problems that you confronted with and come up with what you believe to be is the right thing.
You talk about values. Is that a critical component to one's leadership style? Does it all begin there with your sense of values?
Mike, I absolutely believe that's the case. And you know, at the interpersonal level, I think we would all say that. Well, let me say this. If you did a meritorious corporal board and you asked young Lance Corporals, what do you think the most important leadership quality is? In my day, 90% of them would have said integrity, right? That was the right answer at a board. And so if you believe that leaders have to establish a relationship of trust with their subordinates, and that's really important, then your character and your values are the foundational element of that trust.
Now, working your way up through the ranks from a junior lieutenant to the very senior position in the military, you had a chance to observe a lot of different leadership styles. What kind of buckets would you put them in, and what did you gravitate to and when?
That's a great question, Mike. I mean, I was really fortunate early on as a lieutenant to be exposed to leaders that helped me certainly through my lieutenant and captain. And when I think back of the qualities that that I observed, you know, one was individuals who communicated. You know, I think there's an old expression, being a Marine leader, there's no time for strong silent types. Marines need to hear from you. You need to communicate. You need to explain the environment as you see it. You need to explain the mission and tell them why you're doing something. And they'll figure out the how. They'll do a great job in that regard. And I really did have the benefit of some great leaders. One, you and I have spoken about before. My first battalion commander was an individual by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Hoare. He was later my regimental commander as well when I went to a different battalion. And his positive, persuasive leadership style, he cared about Marines. You could see that. As I always say, you can't fake that. He had a genuine concern for the welfare of Marines. My expression is, when he used to ask you, how are you, he actually waited for the answer. And he was interested in the answer. And so, you know, I had the benefit there. And then at the more senior levels, obviously, as you deal with complex problems, I had the opportunity to watch General Mundy when I was his aide. He was the commandant of the Marine Corps, and get a chance to see what it's like to deal with leadership challenges at the strategic level.
You know, a lot of people outside the military, especially outside the Marine Corps, would think that there's a lot of yelling and shouting and very authoritative rule. In fact, I can even, from my Marine experience, which was way back before yours, but now observing your Marines being embedded with you guys, it's a much calmer, much more professional way of dealing with the troops and communicating.
There's no doubt. Positive, persuasive leadership, I think, is the most effective. And I think it really begins with the quality of young Marines we have. To be honest with you, they're all self-motivated. The quality of Marines, certainly over the last three decades of my career, was extraordinary. They're smart. They're tough. They're committed. They want to do the right thing. And my own experience was that if, as a leader, you did a good job communicating what the expectations were, what the standards were, what the outcome that we needed to achieve was, they'd never let you down. They would go out and make it happen. And I think a big piece of that philosophy in the Marine Corps, Mike, I'd go back to General Al Gray's time as our 29th commandant of the Marine Corps when he introduced maneuver warfare. And if you go back and look at the first publication of the warfighting document called Warfighting that General Gray authored, a key piece of that is the requirement for leaders to answer the question why to their subordinates. And there's even a little exchange and a vignette in the book Warfighting that talks about a young corporal who gets a mission. He kind of scratches his head, says, I'm not sure what this is all about. And then he goes back to his leader, a very senior person, and says, hey, why am I doing this? And they have a right actually to know. And frankly, if you give them the answer to that question, why are we doing this? They're much more likely to come up with an innovative, creative solution to getting to where we need to be, and probably will do a better job than they would have done had you tried to give them some prescription on how to get to the end state.
Now, I saw that play out just before the invasion, which the battalion commander of 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines, took all the Marines to a sand table map of the invasion and spent 2 hours briefing everyone in the unit on where we were going, what the mission was, what the bailout points were, whatever. And that would have never happened when I was in the Marine Corps, about distributing that kind of information all the way down to the ranks, like you say, to these young NCOs who could make decisions on their own.
You know, Mike, not only does it, and that, of course, Lieutenant Colonel Dan O'Donohue, who fully understood this philosophy, but not only does that allow the Marines to understand it better, you know from personal experience as a combat veteran, nothing ever unfolds the way you anticipate. Nothing. And, you know, as people used to say, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. And by doing what Lieutenant Colonel O'Donohue did, which is, you know, consistent with that philosophy that I'm describing, you know, you know that you will have flexibility and adaptation in dealing with the unexpected. Marines won't get to the point where, I'm out of guidance. I don't know what I'm supposed to do now. The plan didn't tell me what to do. They know where we want to be at the end of it. And so as things unfold, particularly in war with combat chaos and friction and uncertainty, they'll be much better equipped to deal with the realities of combat if they're unencumbered by specific guidance and frankly empowered by just, this is what I want you to do and get it done.
This communicating the intent as opposed to explicit orders, is that the way forward now for the Marines and other military services?
Mike, you know, at the tactical and operational level, that's been part of the Marine Corps, you know, really since the 1980s and has matured over time. At the joint world now, in my last job as the chairman, we talked about it in terms of mission command, similar philosophy, even at the strategic level where Secretary of Defense and I would communicate orders on behalf of the Secretary of Defense. We would communicate by mission, and that mission would describe what we wanted to do, but minimize the prescriptions on how to get there.
Because everything's going to change, probably, right?
Because everything's going to change, and what you do is you put the right people in a position of leadership, you give them the right resources, you give them broad guidance, intent, as we just discussed, and they're going to deliver.
When we were talking earlier, I was saying I would imagine your first combatant command going into the Iraq invasion would have been the ultimate test or crucible to your leadership skills. And you kind of said, no, it was kind of a walk in the park. All the leadership came to the run-up of getting ready to go in.
Yeah, you know, I think the walk in the park is your words, not mine.
A sandy park, walking in a desert, I guess.
But I think what I was really trying to convey was that, you know, the years of training, the preparation that we did physically, mentally, spiritually going into that fight, I think prepared us well for the challenges that we confronted. And I think there's an expression from the Romans, the more you sweat in peacetime, the less you bleed in wartime. And I think really that's what I was trying to get at, is that if you work hard before you get there, you're going to be that much better prepared for dealing with a combat environment.
In some ways, were the leadership requirements on your subsequent tours to Iraq, you spent almost 2 years there, and it was a much different Iraq after the invasion when you came back the second time, and I saw you up in Ramadi at the Blue Diamond. The Sunni awakening was happening, the terrorism was beginning. And the Marines were kind of confused as to where this thing's going. This is a different Iraq than we were in before. Did you really have to pull out some different leadership skills to keep people on mission?
To be honest with you, we were focused on stability and security operations. And although there were some threats identified, we did not have an appreciation for the insurgency until we arrived back in Iraq. So it was a very different fight. And I think what that required us to do, it was less a challenge on leadership than once again resetting with communications and trying to explain to the Marines the environment within which we were operating. And we were doing some discovery learning in those early days of 2004 until we truly understood the threat and refined our plans in a way that dealt with the threat.
How did you keep the morale up? I mean, some of the troopers would tell me, the young troops would say, hey, they're not throwing roses at us this time like when we came into Baghdad. And there was a lot of anger and frustration. And these kids didn't know where it was coming from, the enemy, that so to speak. How did you keep people focused on the mission? How do you lead from the front in that case?
When the enemy is operating in and amongst the people in Ramadi, using civilians as shields, conducting improvised explosive device attacks and so forth, it's a completely different fight. But as long as what I found was that by explaining to the Marines what the enemy was trying to do, by putting that in perspective and making sure that they understood what our mission was while we were there and put that in context, it could help minimize some of the frustration. But as you know, an insurgency by definition is just a tough fight, and there's going to be inherent friction, there's going to be frustration and so forth. And again, I think that the key for a leader is to routinely be communicating with your people about the nature of the fight, the nature of the threat, and making sure that the Marines don't lose sight on what it is we're trying to do in that particular case for the Iraqi people.
Jumping forward to your service in Afghanistan and being in charge of all Allied forces, how culturally translatable were your leadership skills and in your toolkit?
Yeah, you know, Mike, not directly. I think the framework for dealing with different cultures is one that, you know, I grew up with in my Marine Corps experience, and it wasn't just Iraq. And so knowing that you needed to listen, knowing you needed to appreciate the problems in the situation from the lens of the people that actually live there, those things carried over.
What about the different military cultures of the Allied forces that you were in command of? Were there any times when you felt another senior military leader from a foreign military would say, well, that's not kind of the way we do it here? Did you ever run up against that?
Not except every day, Mike.
I won't ask you to say which country now.
No, but it actually is a great question, and opens up a really important point, because, and I think it's related to leadership in the military as well as the civilian world. We had 50 countries represented when I arrived in Afghanistan, and many of them have what we call caveats. In other words, they had political instructions that allowed them to do some things, but not other things. And I think when you're building a team, you have to have an appreciation for not only the capabilities and limitations of that team. That's a basic Marine Corps rule of thumb for leaders, is to understand the limitations and the capabilities of your organization. But you also had to understand the political context within which their orders were going to be given. I found myself never asking a military leader to do something that was inconsistent with his or her political guidance, because that was for them how they were going to operate. And I think when you put together, certainly you put together an alliance, that is really an important point. And if you do that, then you can kind of bring together these 50 countries, each one of them operating within their comfort zone.
This being our longest war in U.S. history, how do you ask the troops to hang in there? We used to say in Vietnam, who wants to be the last one to die in Vietnam? I'm sure the troops are asking the same question today. Who wants to be the last to die in Afghanistan? How do you address that?
You know, they have a right to expect that we're out here doing what must be done to protect the American people, to protect the homeland, to protect our way of life. And my assessment is that, hey, well, look, we all get tired from time to time. And when that occurs, you got to kind of step back and reset and remind yourself of the importance of the mission and the need to do the mission, even if a lot of other people have forgotten about the importance of the mission. And in my judgment, the majority of our young people, deployment after deployment, rotation after rotation, have taken that to heart.
What about the most recent Mission Impossible that you just completed inside the perilous beltway of Washington? Lots of snipers, a lot of minefields, a lot of booby traps. How do you serve under two different presidents, six Secretary of Defense, all with different leadership skills, styles? How do you transition through that?
First of all, Mike, I think you have to, in the job I was in, remind yourself constantly of what's important. And what's important was to maintain influence so I could properly represent all of our men and women in uniform, and so I could ensure that the military dimension of whatever problem we were dealing with was well represented. And in order to have influence, you have to have trust, and you have to have credibility. The credibility piece is probably the easier of the two, because that comes from your experience and your reputation, and typically you get in a job like that and the credibility is there. The trust piece is something you have to earn every day. And I think, each of those presidents that I served, all the secretaries of defense I served, had to be confident that I didn't have an agenda, that I was providing to them candid military advice, that I was looking at it through the lens of the problem that they were trying to solve. And that was important. I think they also had a right to believe that the advice I was providing to them would be discreet. And so I was always very careful when I spoke to the media, when I testified in Congress, any kind of public venue, that I protected the military advice that I was providing to the president or the Secretary of Defense, as the case may be. And so, you know, you go back to the George Washingtons and the Marshalls, which are kind of the North Star for leadership at that level. And you think about the nonpartisan culture that the U.S. military has adopted over the years. and you think about the candid advice you're expected to provide in private, but not necessarily in public, then collapse the decision space that a senior leader has by saying, well, I'm not sure why the leader made this decision. This was my recommendation. I think in that position I was in, you have to realize that, well, the military factor is a one consideration for complex problems. The President of the United States and the Secretary of Defense have a wider lens through which they look, and you have to have an appreciation for that as well. But I guess I'd summarize it by saying that in order to be effective as a senior military leader, you have to be trusted by your political leadership. And to be trusted by your political leadership requires you to be candid, requires you to be discreet, and requires you to kind of take a look at the problem they're trying to solve and help them solve that problem.
Does it also require knowing what battles to fight and how hard to fight them?
Mike, I think that's fair. That's not to say that you ever have to be in a position where you compromise your principles or you compromise your integrity. I don't think that's the case. But there are certain times when I guess I would say more important than knowing what battles to fight is knowing when the decision is made. And so knowing that before the decision is made, you have the latitude to try to shape the decision, looking at it through the lens of the military dimension.
But if it's a done deal, move on.
If it's a done deal, then you should execute like it was your idea. And if you think about it, that's what you expect out of a corporal. That's what you expect out of a lieutenant. And I think the American people have a right to expect that that's exactly what you get out of a general, albeit in a different environment, different context. But the principle of once a decision is made, executing that decision like it was your idea is one that is applicable at every level of leadership.
One of the reasons why we're doing this series is a lot of people are talking about leadership today because our society, all sectors of society are being challenged. There are leadership challenges that are the greatest we've probably had in our living history for all of us. And a lot of people think there's a leadership void, that COVID and the debates over racial equality and whatever has kind of laid bare some kind of systemic shortcomings in leadership. Do you feel that way at all?
Well, look, Mike, I think it's fair to say, and we shouldn't miss this opportunity, that there's some tremendous case studies out there for both good leaders and leaders who maybe have something desired. And so while it's easy to focus on the negative piece, and since I won't name names on the negative piece, I won't name names on the positive piece either. But I think what you're really alluding to is political leadership. And if you look at the federal level, the state level, and the local level, I think there's as many examples of strong, good leaders who have done the hard right as there are of leaders who perhaps have missed the mark here during a particularly challenging time. And in my view, that's no different than any other than in any other conditions. I mean, the same thing happens in combat. You use the word expose. Difficult challenges expose leaders. And you're gonna learn a lot about a leader, not so much when things are easy, but when things are challenging. And things have been challenging in our country over the last few months. And so you learn a lot about somebody when they're under pressure.
I was quite surprised to see how much government has depended on military leaders now in all different parts of the equation. It doesn't surprise me knowing how capable today's military is, but are you surprised that people like yourselves have been asked to step in very non-military situations? Most recently, you were asked to run the oversight commission on the stimulus spending. Are you surprised that the government and society at large are really looking to military leaders to lead from the front?
Well, you know, Mike, I think when I look at the people that have been selected, so let's do present company excluded, it's less that they were military leaders than they're quality people who have something to offer. I think the fact that individual leaders have been asked to do things that are beyond just military tasks is truly a reflection of some of the quality people that we have in uniform in our country. And it's not new, right? I mean, if you go back in history, after every war, when you know Americans have come home, many of those who served in uniform then went on to make a significant contribution in the business world and the political world and so forth. And so I'm not sure this is a new phenomenon. I do think it's received a great deal of attention here over the last 4 or 5 years, but historically you can name many times when our nation has gone to military leaders to step up and do things and to include be the President of the United States. If you look at President Eisenhower, if you look at Grant, or if you look at someone who served in World War II, you can look at almost every president post World War II until the 1990s that has served in war. Bush, Nixon, Kennedy, Johnson, Eisenhower all had served at some point.
But are you really a kind of a serial leader, Joe? I mean, you have your encore leadership career now. You're still involved in Afghanistan. You're still working on trying to find a solution there with the Afghanistan study group. You're still involved with Marines with the Semper Fi Fund. Are you as excited now about the leadership you have to demonstrate in these various capacities as you were as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff?
You know, I am, Mike. I mean, it's certainly a different environment that I find myself in today. But when I look at the mission of the organizations I'm working with, you mentioned the Semper Fi and America's Fund as being one of them. That's a mission to keep faith with our wounded, ill, and injured soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. No more important mission, so it's easy to wake up in the morning and get excited about that. Working on the Afghan study group, another example, and there's many others, but this is a difficult challenge. We've been at war a long time, and people are saying they're tired of Afghanistan, and why don't we simply come home? And I think having the opportunity to sit with a really high quality group of people to think through how we advance our interests in South Asia and in Afghanistan and bring that war to a successful conclusion and foster a peace in the region that will allow us to meet our national interests at a lower level of resources is a really important task. And as I mentioned earlier, some people can afford to get tired. My philosophy is that when you serve in uniform or even after you serve in uniform, you can't afford to get tired. There's plenty to be done. And I've been lucky to find myself with a few things that I can sink my teeth into and continue to make in a small way some kind of a contribution.
Well, General Dunford, thank you for your incredible service to country, to our Corps, to the Marines Memorial Club during this very challenging period. We look forward to having you back here when things get back to normal. Because before I started the interview, General Hewley reminded me that he doesn't take virtual chits. And so this one doesn't count. And so next time you come back to San Francisco, we'd like to have you in the theater and do this like we normally would do it.
Well, Mike, I thank you for that. And for General Hewley, you can remind him that I remember what he taught me about leadership. When I worked for General Hewley, he was a 3-star and I was a 1-star. He would routinely say to me, Joe, if there's anything I can do to help you short of actual assistance, please let me know.
Well, we really appreciate this real assistance that you're giving today. And I know General Mike Rocco, who's going to succeed General Hewley, is really looking forward to seeing you here back at the club again.
By the way, when you mentioned General Rocco, I just say the club has been blessed, as you know, to have now three great leaders in a row, from General Myatt, who was my former MU commander, to General Hewley, who was my boss a couple of times, to Mike Rocco, who I consider a great friend and a great Marine. And so I'm delighted that the club is going to have his leadership here for the next few years.
Well, we're looking forward to it and looking forward to continuing to observe and learn from the leadership skills that you've been demonstrating throughout your career and our continued.
Hey, thanks, Mike.
The Marines Memorial Association and Foundation that run the Marines Memorial Club, they do a series of interviews, and that was one of them. Joe Dunford's very accomplished at saying nothing. He can make nothing sound incredible, and he does on a regular basis. It's difficult to do interviews with guys like that because you're so excited to interview them, and then you can't get him to say anything. And, you know, maybe in generalities, great generalities, maybe. So, anyway. All right, if you're a baseball fan, let me tell you what's on tap today. And if you're just tuning in, hour one turns into hour 1.34. You're going to hear Scent of a Woman. You're going to hear A Few Good Men. You're going to hear all kinds of stuff in there. So, yeah. I asked the question in hour one, like, what the hell's going on? I joined the Marine Corps in 1983. I never, ever remember, and neither do any of my friends, an aircraft colliding with a refueler. And now in less than 22 months, it's happened twice. We have ships that run into each other now. We have another ship that burns pier side for 5 days. It's a joke. But yet, all we hear about the military is your social benefits, you know, gender integration, you know, this systemic bias in it. What about excellence and what the fuck you do? Is that completely lost? Right? $100 million aircraft got flown into the ground yesterday for lack of the skills, the basic skills to join a tanker, refuel, and then uncouple from that and fly away. Something extremely basic in aviation. Never in my career do I remember a collision between a refueler and an aircraft. And now in the space of 22 months. Now, is this blip, along with the CNO having a heart attack? Is this just another, you know, another pebble that paves the path to a military that's more concerned with its social contribution than it is with its military one? And let me tell you, historically, how the military priority gets back in focus. Somebody kicks your ass. That's how it happens. So, excellence of what you do. I don't know what to say. So, that's coming up. That's coming up next. So, have a great day on a Wednesday. All Marine Radio. Out.